Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
And welcome to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And boy, oh boy, John, there's been plenty to talk about in sport since we last did the podcast.
Oh, absolutely. It's all been happening. And of course, maybe the biggest story is the day-night test.
It has indeed. I'm still a traditionalist. I see it went very well. The crowds, according to Channel 9, were the best on TV, so they're obviously going to stick with it, but you know, I'm not sure about it personally.
It was there was a lot of talk about what the pink ball would do, and then the pink ball sort of didn't do what people said it would do, and a lot of wickets fell during the day sessions, which was probably surprising to people looking on. It was expected that night would be difficult to bat, and it was, but I don't think people were expecting the day sessions to be as hard as they were.
I think the thing I look at, though, with this day-night cricket is I understand that the world is changing and what consumers want is changing, but it just kind of worries me how every sport now is pandering to what I call the fast food way of life. If you've looked, we've got T20, and then I don't know if you saw the article this week that Leandro Negre, who is the president of the International Hockey Federation, has said that Dr. Thomas Bach, who's the head of the IOC, liked hockey fives and asked why that wasn't an Olympic sport. So I think we're going to see hockey fives, which is played at the Australian Youth Olympic, or sorry, the International Youth Olympics, may well take over from 11-a-side hockey. And I just think, well, where are all these traditions going? Are we going to start bastardizing every single sport and just killing off over 100 years of history?
It's the dumbing down of society in general. It's the dumbing down of sport too. I mean, the whole point of a five-day game of cricket was it's a test. And if you start, you know, now we've had on the eve of the Adelaide test, blokes like Shane Warne and Mark Taylor coming out saying, oh, the four-day test, we should go back to 4 days. Preempting what was going to happen in the upcoming test. No surprise, both of those gentlemen are in the paid employ of broadcaster. But it just strikes me that we're continually dumbing down our sport. And it's reflected in the rest of society.
It is. I mean, and if you look as well, I don't know if you saw that the Australian cricket are even considering taking on the same rule change that they're bringing into county cricket next year in the UK, where they're going to do away with the toss of the coin. What they're going to do is the visiting team will have the option to, I think it's bowl first in every occasion, and then should they turn that down, they will toss the coin. And the reason they've brought that in is because they're saying that the wickets favour the home side. Well, if that's the case, you have a match referee. Fine the club for not preparing a good cricket wicket. Why would you tamper with the rules because you're not prepared to actually come down hard on clubs who don't prepare good cricket wickets?
Whenever this subject of the toss comes up, I have to shake my head because I can see what people make the argument against the toss and the way that it's biased at the moment. But every other system you come up with has a bias in it. Even the system they're talking about there has a bias in it. Now, you've been playing cricket a lot, following cricket a long time, Ashley. How many times have you heard of commentators or captains or players say, yeah, well, I thought the wicket looked pretty flat, so we decided to bat, and they're at 5 for 26. The toss is not always a precursor of what's going to happen in the game, and not everyone can read a pitch right all the time. Sometimes pitches surprise people.
Absolutely, and so I think this is, to me, and the thing that scares me is they had a panel of people came up with this idea, which included Andrew Strauss and Andy Flower, and you think, for crying out loud, you know, so you paid these guys to sit around a table to discuss how the wickets are going to improve, and they came up with that? I mean,
exactly.
What are we doing? These governing bodies are just creating quangos for ex-players. Exactly like you said, they're Mark Taylor influenced by a broadcaster beyond belief to say a four-day test. And it just, we need to start standing up to it, I think.
I found the conversation leading into Adelaide really interesting in the media because it was setting us up to get used to the idea that tests won't go 5 days anymore. And especially this one, there was a lot of concerns that this test wouldn't go the distance, and it didn't. It went 3 days. Now, if a test went 3 days at the Wacker, they would be pilloring the wicket, absolutely pilloring it, regardless of the ball. So, you know, you just wonder what's going on. And what's wrong with the toss anyway? I mean, you know, the home side will set up the wicket for itself. What happens if the home side bloody loses the toss, mate? I mean, it doesn't always go the way you want it to go.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, as you alluded to before, why do test matches not last 4 days? Most of the time now is because the players lack the technique and the application to be able to bat long innings.
I'll tell you what, I saw a great example of it on Sunday night. Mitch Marsh, he was batting with Sean. He just mishit a six straight down the ground. Australia needs 21s to win. They've got 2 days to bat, two and a bit days to bat, and he tries to hit the next one out of the park as well and gets caught and he's out. Now, that can be a career killer, a shot like that. Ask Matthew Wade about the hook shot he tried to play in the Sydney Test against Sri Lanka. Never played Test cricket again.
Ask Damien Martin. I mean, he suffered the same fate.
He did, the Sydney Test, famously. At least he got his opportunity again later down the track. But I think you're right about, and that comes back to the dumbing down of the game. Do we just want to see blokes standing there and swinging their bats and trying to hit the ball as far as they can every time? Do we really want T20? Or do we want a sport where both batsman and bowler are tested?
Well, I know what I want.
Yeah, you and me both. We might be the only blokes playing it in 20 years' time.
I think in about 20 years' time, John, then I'm just going to be watching DVDs or videos of former games from the past.
I think I might be joining you. Might be a long afternoon on the couch, that one. The world is bad.
Bad. She's bad. Hi, I'm JC Jand from West Coast Fever, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, it's probably time we move on to our first guest, and the Women's World Floorball World Cup is about to take place at the start of December. And before they set off overseas, I caught up with Australia's Phoebe Hamilton and Blaise Hodges.
Well, Phoebe Hamilton and Blaise Hodges, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on.
No, it'd be really good to catch up with you. Now, we'll probably start with you, Phoebe, because you originally hail from Canberra but have decided to make the move across to WA to basically enhance your preparation for the World Championships. Was that an easy decision to make?
I think it was the right decision. I think there was just a lot more opportunity for me to get in training time, and then with the national coach over here, obviously. I'm quite lucky in that I'm just a student, I'm working part-time, so I had the choice to just defer uni for a little while and actually come over here and focus on my floor, which has just been amazing because there's just so many less distractions when all you've got to focus on really is prepping for the comp.
What's floorball like in Canberra? Because obviously we've focused a lot on the game here in Western Australia, but is it strong over there?
Yeah, it's really expanding in Canberra at the moment, actually. So it's a little more new in Canberra than it is somewhere like WA, but we're definitely the base of people that are playing it there is ever-expanding. And, we've got a couple of comps that have just started up, and there's more continuing. We've got some juniors programs that are happening there now, which is really great to see, and a lot of really dedicated people that are working really hard to keep it going.
Now, Blaise, you also made the move over to the West, but you're from Melbourne. You've been here a little bit longer now.
Yeah, I've been here for about 4 years now, so pretty much a local.
And what was it made you make the move? Was it, again, the standard over here in WA?
A similar thing to Phoebe. I was just looking to improve my floorball more over background from, I play in Pakenham, and it's a really strong local club competition, but that's all we've really got going. We don't get to get out a lot and play against other clubs. So moving over here, there's a lot of really well-established clubs and a lot of experienced people who have played overseas, so lots to learn.
This is going to be your third World Championships, if I'm right.
Yes, it's my third, so...
How much have you learnt from the others, and do you feel that the team is getting much better every time around?
I think this time round, it's going to be quite difficult. It's a bigger challenge. We've got a really young team, a lot of new players, so it's really time for people like me and Phoebe to sort of step up and bring the experience in the team to an extent, which is exciting. But we've been very lucky to be brought up with some very experienced girls who've played a lot in Europe, where it's really strong, so...
I love the way you say it's time you both stood up. You're 22 and Phoebe, you're only 20. So, I mean, is that a lot of responsibility on young shoulders?
Maybe, but I mean, I guess you have to rise to the occasion. And I'm just really, really excited just to give it my all. And I guess that's all we can do. And I'm really excited to see everyone else step up as well.
The one thing it appears, though, is that Floorball Australia is looking very much to build long-term. That's why they've gone with a young squad. And I believe they announced a development squad as well in recent times. Do you think that is the way to go and that you've got to look, maybe not this tournament, get the experience, but then in two tournaments down the track, you're going to be really challenging?
Yeah, I guess that's always the thing, really, because otherwise you're going to get to a point where you don't have any players with any experience. So, yeah, like they said, it's a bit of a shift this year, and I think it's a really great thing for the sport, and I think it's a really good opportunity, like, for younger players like us to really step up and come into our own, and yeah, good things to come in the future for Australia Floorball.
Blaise, I mean, do you think we'll ever see the World Championships hosted by Australia?
I think it's not in the near future, but we're really hopeful for one day that something like that could happen. I think when you look at the numbers of people who are registered in Europe versus over here, it's a good 10 years away. It's probably still, we're more in a development stage of looking to build up numbers and clubs and get a really strong local comp going and then move from there.
Did you both play in the qualifiers
to get
to the World Champs?
Yeah.
And Australia came third in those, didn't they? Was that a little bit disappointing?
Considering we won it 2 years ago, we won the qualifiers, it probably was a disappointing result. It was a real eye-opener for us, though, to really have a look at how we're playing and sort of have to step up again. I think we all had really high expectations and maybe put too much pressure on ourselves or maybe thought it was going to be easier than what it was. So moving into World Champs, we've just had to step up preparations just to the next level.
Singapore's going to be in your group. They were the team that actually topped it in the qualifiers. So is that going to be a tough game? Because I think that's your first game at the World Champs.
I think that's probably one of the games I'm looking at the most forward to, because it's always good to, you know, learn a lesson, you know, maybe take a step back, be a bit more humble in where we're at as a team, and now I think to really bring it to them, because I think we can, and it'll be a really good game, I think.
Denmark's another team, I presume they're a very strong side, and then you've also got Japan, who also played in the same qualifier, so it's almost like a replay of the qualifiers for the World Champs.
Just about. It's probably good for us, though, to start. I mean, in terms of the continents, our sort of Asian-Pacific continent is probably the weaker against sort of the European team. So it's good to sort of start with them and use that as a stepping stone before we match up against stronger European teams.
And I believe you're going into a camp before the tournament starts. That will be really good, but you haven't got that much time. I think it's only about a week in camp.
It's a bit over a week, I think. But I guess all of our fitness and prep in that sense has all been done before, either individually or in our state groups. And once we get to the camp, it's just a real chance for us to kind of learn how the people that maybe we don't know so well play and really gel as a team. I think that's going to be the main focus there.
Well, Blaise, you've been there before, and how difficult is that, the fact that you don't get together as a team very often and it is only just before a major tournament and you have to try and gel really, really quickly?
I think the good thing is, particularly for me and Phoebe, we've been on both the West Coast and the East Coast, so we have had an opportunity to play with most of the players in the team before, and more importantly, we have previous friendships that we've established in national tournaments, which does help sort of when you get together, you're just all there for the same goal. And also with the preparation from our coach Grant, it's been a lot of speaking about tactics, although it's been through email and online, it's been very in-depth, so it's all sort of given us like an idea to put in our heads of what we want to achieve. So
I have to say, if Grant is as thorough with the preparation for you as he was in giving me information about meeting you two, it must be excellent preparation. But Phoebe, I believe you're also looking to maybe go over and play in Finland in the future. Is that on the cards yet?
Definitely. I mean, I think for most people who are really passionate about floorball here, you know, they'd all love to go and play over in Europe. And I mean, especially Finland and Sweden just have a really amazing league over there. And if an opportunity came up, then I would happily grasp it, and I guess we'll just see what happens, see what presents itself.
How about you, Blaise? I mean, you've been here in WA for a while. I mean, there must be that little bit of an itch to go and test yourself in the best leagues.
Definitely. For anyone who's serious about floorball, it's the next step that you have to take. If you look at all the people in our WA league who have played overseas, who've had that experience, they just understand and read the game a lot better. So really anyone who wants to get there has to look at it at some point in the future. So
has it helped when you've had imports come here to develop your games?
Definitely. I mean, we've had a lot of girls who we've played with in the past in the Australian team who have played overseas in European leagues, and they just bring so much to the team and so much experience and all the little tips. You just can't get that from anywhere else, so not in Australia anyway.
Is there anyone who's been a key influence to you, Phoebe? I mean, we're still very young and you're still certainly on the rise.
I don't know, I think I've kind of taken a lot of little things from everywhere. For me, specifically, I first played floorball over in Sweden, and I know that that my coach that I had over there was a really big impact on, obviously, my take on the sport. But yeah, I think I've picked up little things from everywhere, and you know, you can never stop learning new things, and I just love seeing other people's take on the sport and what they can do with it, and then trying to, I guess, incorporate into my own game.
Now, the World Championships, they run from the 4th of December to the 12th of December. Slightly different to how they were a few years ago, aren't they, now, in that it's a sort of group stage and then it's a knockout, is that right? Whereas there before you were in divisions?
Yeah. Yeah, it used to be an A and a B division competition, which the girls, this is before my time, but actually won in, I think, 2009. They won the B division comp, which automatically qualified them for the next world champs. But now it's more split into pools, so we get more of an opportunity to play against these really good teams like Finland and Sweden.
What is the goal for you both going into this? Obviously to get out of the pool stage, but how far do you think you can go?
I think I'd really love for us to make top 10. I think it's a bit of a stretch, but I think that you know, you have to aim high, and yeah, I would just be absolutely over the moon with a result like that. So I guess that's what I'd be heading for.
Blaise, are you the same or a little bit more ambitious?
I think I'm very similar. I'm just looking forward to seeing all the young girls who haven't played internationally before really get a good grasp on it, and sort of all the young girls are very athletic, very keen, and I just can't wait to see what they're capable of, and I know that they're going to be very important for the future of the sport. So I just want to see everyone get a lot out of it and look to be placing higher in the future.
Would you have any advice for those making their debut? Because I mean, it's sometimes, even though you can play at that level and they've got the talent, you can get a little bit overawed when you realise, whoa, I'm playing at a World Championships.
Yeah, there's nothing more overwhelming for me or more important for me than representing my country on an international level. So it's very hard not to put pressure on yourself to want to not only do your best, but just impress everyone. And if you just keep the goals in mind and keep working towards the team, then it's really easy to keep an eye on the goal.
Well, everyone can keep an eye on your performances. I believe they're on the IFFF YouTube channel. Yeah. And it will be great to catch up with you both when you get back. But we wish you all the very best, and let's hope you can get out of the pool and get that top 10 position. Thank you, Phoebe.
Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you, Blaise.
Thanks again. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
We wish them all the very best over in the Floorball World Cup. It is amazing how Perth now is attracting some of these players to come across from the East Coast to prepare and give themselves a better chance to get into the international scene. And I think it shows how Floorball WA has done just a great job in building the game up over here, John.
Oh, they've done a tremendous job. In the time we've been following the sport, the growth has been phenomenal. And I'm starting to meet floorball players around hockey circles. There's certainly a growing number of them.
It is, and we touched on this before in that I've heard that, you know, the FIH is talking very, very closely with floorball, because floorball now has the numbers. I think it's 52 countries have to play it to be able to apply for Olympic inclusion. And I think hockey sees that as a dangerous thing as well, apart from the five-a-side version of the game. And they're thinking maybe we should get in bed with floorball and then become one sort of body together. It's going to be interesting, though. Floorball's made such advances. Are they want to get in bed with the FIH?
Well, it's interesting because I think you'll probably find the power base of floorball is very much European, whereas the power base of hockey is very much subcontinental. So exactly, you know, how those two forces play off against each other might be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and most of the floorball powers are sort of Scandinavian or Eastern European, so not the traditional hockey hotbeds.
And as you say, when you mentioned Perth before, Ash, it's so good that even indoor sports are coming to Perth now because the weather's so good. Now, while you've been away there in India, how's the hockey been?
It's been interesting. I did the Junior Asia Cup, as you know, before, and that was it was a thrilling tournament, although the structure of the tournament saw Japan and Malaysia in their last pool games basically not try to win because they wanted to avoid South Korea in the quarterfinals. So it was actually a very, very difficult game to commentate, and it was very obvious when Japan swept their first penalty corner attempt probably about 20 metres wide. So I think the organisers need to really look at that and maybe do as FIFA did and somehow have games played at the same time if they're going to have an impact on the draw further, you know, in the competition. And that could have been done because there were two games going on at the same time. But up here in India, I mean, we've got the cream of world hockey playing in the Hockey World League finals. And, yeah, I mean, every game is a tough game. It's interesting how teams are approaching it. A lot of them have brought young players who they're obviously seeing maybe smokies for the Olympic Games. Some of them are taking the pool games a little bit easy. We get into the quarterfinals today, it starts, so it'll be interesting to see how those pan out.
Oh, this is the last chance, really, for a lot of teams to tinker, because once you get past Christmas this year, you're going to a serious Olympic preparation, and they'd be getting pretty close to who they would pick in their Olympic squads, I imagine, all of the teams in Australia especially. I wonder if there's not a few blokes out there for Australia that are just biding their time as far as they're just running around and staying fit more than anything else.
Well, I have heard that some of the Australians who've been picked for the Hockey India League are actually going to be withdrawing their services for various reasons, so I can't really say anything at the moment, but I would just say to hockey fans, watch this space. I think there's some big names may now pull out to hold themselves back in the hope of making it to the Rio Olympics.
Well, I'm looking forward to the running to Rio, actually. It's going to be interesting to see the makeup of the Australian team come this Olympics. I think the previous couple of Olympics, it's been, there might be one or two spots up for grabs, but I think this time around there's probably half a dozen spots.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing I would be interested to hear feedback from anyone who listens to this podcast, and they can comment either on the website, which is www.notthefootyshow.com, or they can obviously comment on our Facebook pages, what they make of the TV coverage, because Star Sports have bought the rights for the next 8 years. They're trying to revolutionise the way that hockey is shown, and there is now a ticker along the bottom of the screen. Obviously, I'm part of the commentary team, and it's interesting from our perspective, but it would be interesting to hear what the viewers make of it all.
Oh, I'm sure I can get a few comments coming your way. Actually, people around the where I've been playing my hockey in the last few weeks and certainly been talking about it and noticing your fantastic work, I must say.
Oh, well, that's nice to know. I'm sure you're hiding a few bad comments from me.
No. And just going back to the Junior World Cup, you mentioned Japan throwing that game to get a better semi-final. What was the outcome of that?
Oh, look, Japan, if they'd have won, they would have come second in the pool, which would have meant they would have had to have played South Korea. So they basically did not attack Malaysia. Malaysia scored first, then Japan were happy to attack because a draw meant they would remain third, which they got a goal just before, I think it was half time. Malaysia then scored after the break, so Japan attacked again, and it finished in a 2-2 draw.
Where did that put Japan?
Japan then basically played Bangladesh in the quarterfinals. Yep. And what it meant was that the teams that won the quarterfinals went through to the semifinals, and that meant they qualified for the Junior World Cup. Japan beat Bangladesh, so they qualified, which was very important for them as the hosts of the Olympic Games in 2020, because this junior team is a team that is building with the goal of 2020 in Japan. It meant Malaysia played South Korea, which was going to be a very tough match, and Malaysia lost and therefore missed out on a Junior World Cup berth. And so their senior teams missed out on the Olympics. Their junior team has now missed out on a Junior World Cup. And so they are really, really down in the dumps about where their hockey is at the moment. But Terry Walsh has just taken over as the technical director up in Malaysia, and I'm sure he will turn things around fairly quickly.
And you know, in any international elite sport, the difference between 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th is not that great. I mean, one goal here, a goal there, you're not playing in that game, you're playing in this game. It's such a fine, fine line.
Oh, it is. And that's the sad thing, and that's what's so painful for all those top athletes, isn't it? That it is the finest of margins that determines whether 4 years of hard work sees them achieve their goal of going to the Olympic Games or not.
Oh, absolutely. Just while we're on hockey, Ashley, I'd like to send out a thanks to the Sikh Association. A couple of weeks ago, I played in their Diwali, I hope I pronounced that right, tournament, down at the Melville Turf there for older players. We'll call them older players, although some of them weren't that old. It was a fantastic day. They put on a really good show. Food was excellent, great big pots of rice and curry, and the ladies had all on their best colourful clothing, played in tremendous spirit with a great bunch of blokes, and it was a really good day. So look forward to it again next year, and well done to the Sikh Association.
Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me, hit me. Je t'adore, ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me slowly, hit me quick. Hit me.
That probably is a good lead, actually, John, into our second guest on this. And it was while I was at the Junior Asia Cup, I caught up with a gentleman called Ahmed Khan, who's involved with the Shaheen Sports Club in Hong Kong. And they're using hockey to try and help underprivileged and also a lot of the new immigrants to Hong Kong. And when I was having a conversation with him, it was just amazing to hear what they were trying to do. So I thought it would be really good to share what they're trying to do with our listeners. And so I caught up with him. There is a little bit of background noise because we were struggling to find a quiet spot during this interview, but hopefully you can still hear what he's telling us and what the Shaheen Sports Club are trying to do in Hong Kong. Ahmed Khan, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you. Hi, Ashley.
Well, it's great to catch up with you, and I wanted to find out a little bit more about Shaheen Sports Club in Hong Kong, because it sounds like you're doing amazing things for a lot of people, not just people who love the game of hockey.
Well, actually, we are doing some kind of program for the children in Hong Kong. We like to educate them to become an athlete and to know, understand much more about sports, the essence of sports, like sportsmanship, respect, and all that. So we have some kind of, it's called Project Nova. We pick up students from the school. So we educate them and then we coach them in playing hockey as a team. So we send them to teams and all that. And those children, pick them is mostly from underprivileged school.
And how long has this been going and whose idea was it?
Well, it's been almost like 3 or 4 years already, and it's my idea. It's a little bit sounds like crazy when I propose it, and now it's working out very fine, very well. Everything is okay, and I think we have over like 50 or 60 children now benefit.
And what's the children's reaction to it? I mean, obviously they're getting exposed to a sport that I wouldn't have thought is that big in Hong Kong, and a sport that some of them might know very little about.
I think not the student reactor, it's the teachers and the headmasters. We call like 34 schools in our district, and none of them allow until I got the NGO, some non-government organization, and then they put me into the a group. So we went into school. Now we have like 14 schools, and the students, they are really shocked when we discuss them. We talk to them, tell them about like what is the career in hockey. They can be a coach, they can be an umpire, of course they can be a player.
Well, one of the things you have done is also give them the opportunity to make a little bit of money as well.
Yes, because in Hong Kong, we have umpires. Umpires were paid. They were paid for like a game like $200 or something Hong Kong dollars. And coaches, they were paid also. So we trained them as coach and umpire.
And what's the reaction being given the chance? I mean, you said they're underprivileged children, but suddenly you're giving them the chance to get a skill, to become an umpire. And I'm presuming that some of them would wonder, why have they been blessed with that opportunity?
Yes, some of them, they're really wondering why choose me, you know. So I told them that, look, we have an opportunity. It depends on you, whether you like to take it. And if you like to take it, we'll give you all the support so one day you achieve your goals. And
you said that the club thought you were mad when you suggested this idea. What's the feeling at the club now?
Well, everybody support nowadays. I mean, I don't have any obstacle. Everybody support, coaches support, management support, and our directors or whatever. Everybody support this.
And I believe the club now has even purchased some land to progress this even further.
Actually, we don't purchase. We don't have money. And we apply lands from the government. And so fortunate, the government, you know, they trust us, what we have achieved. And they give us a small piece of land to develop hockey in Hong Kong. And also develop some programs like team buildings, team leaderships and all that.
And you're still not happy with where it is. You want to grow it even more. I saw your target is 50 more schools in 3 years.
Well, actually, we got another program for coming 3 years. We want to have the target of like 50 schools. And the reason why I'm doing this, so we can have more hockey players. They can be full-time coach. So they got a job that they can go into the school and coach them to play hockey, coach the student to play hockey. That is how it goes.
And how are you coaching the coaches at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we develop quite a number of coaches. At first, we start like pre-level 1, and then level 1, and then level 2. So we coach them, and we give them some of the safety facts that, you know, safety is quite important. And in the school, we're going to simplify the hockey rules. We are using a basketball court to play hockey. So it's going to be like 5-a-side.
And are you looking to maybe encourage players, say, from other parts of Asia to come and be guest coaches?
Yes, we are. In fact, next year, I think in April or May, we are inviting some coaches to come to Hong Kong. And we are also doing one program for umpires, inviting umpires from Asia to come and join us.
We've seen China obviously progress since the Olympic Games in 2008. Their team has really come up in the world rankings. Is Hong Kong going to have a team that's going to maybe contest with China, South Korea?
No, I doubt very much at this moment. We are a little bit way down. We are now playing in the third tier, which is the Asia Challenge. Because in Asia, we have Asia Cup, Asia Hockey Federation Cup, and we are now in the Asia Federation, Asia Challenge. So it's still another long time to go up.
And what is your goal? I mean, obviously, you set up this to give the opportunity, and I believe you were saying it's really helping people sort of assimilate with refugees as well.
Yes, we are. We are setting up another new program that we are picking up some refugees. Or, you know, we're not from the refugees camp because the refugees are all over living in the NGO's house and all that. So we have communicated with them. So probably another, like, in August, we're going to do that.
What's your end goal? Because it seems like you've got so many things on the go.
Well, actually, I think my main goal is to give people an option. You know, give them a chance to give them, like, dignity. A lot of people that just hang around in the garden in Hong Kong, sitting there doing nothing. So we give them something so they will contribute. And the other thing is what we have already did like 2 or 3 years ago. We encourage the family, the children, parents to join us. So we have a caring group. So the parents will cook food and all that. So they will go and visit the old age home, distributing rice, mooncake and all that.
So it sounds like Shaheen is really about community. It's really about the old-fashioned sport where everybody mucks in and you're all there together.
I think, yes, we miss that. You know, sports is a way that we meet friends. And we are not creating enemies, so we need to meet more and more friends and let the next generation to understand why friends is important.
And is there one sort of success story you can tell us so far, or is it too early to be picking out one child that maybe has really blossomed?
Well, in fact, we have two kids when they first joined us like 4 or 5 years ago, and now they're training with the Hong Kong Under 21. We are looking forward to see them, you know, after maybe a couple of months, they become a Hong Kong Under 21 players.
It's a fantastic story, and if somebody who's listening to this in Australia or where else, if they wanted to get involved, are you still looking for donations and help?
Oh yes, we always look for donations. We always look for support.
And what are you looking for? Is it for financial support, or are you looking for equipment?
Well, actually, we need for equipment and fundings as well. Of course, if any coaches, you know, in Australia, they are very high level in coaches. If some coaches, they say, okay, I'm on holiday to Hong Kong, they can come and contact us. We can, you know, they can like give us some coaching course or some workshop.
Well, I'll see if I can put out the word there, because I think it's a fantastic thing that you're doing, and I wish you all the very best, and hopefully we can talk again in the future.
Thanks a lot, Ashley. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Samir Dutt, Olympian hockey player. You're watching on me, Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Ahmed Khan from the Shaheen Sports Club in Hong Kong, and I just couldn't get over some of the wonderful work they're doing in showing how sport can actually give people opportunities in life and also just help people integrate into society. And I think sometimes in the professional world today, we forget that, how important it is as a social tool.
In many ways, I agree with you, Ashley, and it's something I was talking to someone about the other night, actually, this particular subject, but on a more local scale. Sport does do all of those sorts of things, but I think we should be very careful when we're dealing with underprivileged people that we don't make it out that sport is their only way out of the situation that they find themselves in. And I think very often communities that have been marginalised or disenfranchised given sport as the only way they can get out, and then they don't have other role models outside of sport, and that the society outside of those communities focuses on sport as being a way for these people to get out of the situations that they find themselves in.
Now, I think that's that's a very valid point, because of course, you know, if you're in one of those communities and you're no good at sport, then you think your life is doomed, which is obviously never the case. You know, it's going to be tough, but you have to find that little niche there where you can try and carve your own path.
But in a society where Justin Bieber and Kanye West are seen as role models and other sports people of not very high moral repute, you know, we've got to be careful about exactly what the role models we are creating for our future children and our grandchildren. And not that sport can't be a very strong and positive part of that, and it should be a very strong and positive part of it.
Absolutely.
Now, Ashley, have you caught up with the latest from the world of the FFA?
Oh, look, I've been trying to follow it from afar, and it's been interesting, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I must admit, I'm quite staggered by the fans' reaction. I think it's been totally over the top and overblown. And I think it actually reinforces to a lot of Australians what they don't like about football, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that a lot of people have felt that they've been, some of them, not all of them, some of them have been, you know, obviously expelled from grounds around Australia, and they've had no right of reply. Now, the FFA have claimed that they do have a right of reply, but it obviously hasn't been that apparent as to how they do challenge their banning. But it is the one thing I would say about the fans' protest, John, is something that I've been saying for a long time, is that people power is a very strong thing. And the one thing I thought was quite good was seeing the fans all work together to walk out of the stadium. Now, I've been banging on about the clubs around this country pulling together for the good of the game and standing up to decisions which are not for the good of the game, and actually using their power to influence the future and the path down which the game travels. And yet the clubs fail to do this year in, year out. They look after their own self-interest. And it just encouraged me that at least the fans could actually stand united as one. Whether it was right, whether it was wrong, whether it was the right approach, that's irrelevant. But it showed that unity that the clubs in this country fail to do on a regular basis. And it gave me some hope that maybe if some of those people that did unite actually got involved in local football and stood shoulder to shoulder again, we might actually be able to take the game down a path that it needs to travel rather than the path it's being forced to travel at the moment.
One of the things that's come out in some of the talkback too is this idea that of infiltration of criminal groups or gangs into clubs, which is, I find, a little bit staggering, to be honest. That's going on. I'm sure it is. These are people who go to the games. I don't go to enough games to know if that's true. Certainly, my experience at Perth Glory, I've never seen what you think of as sort of gang-like behaviour. Might be a bit boisterous and over the top. But at the same time, football's got to realise that there is a problem in the sport. And I'm constantly being told by football supporters that it's a global game. Well, the problems are global problems. They might not necessarily be ours in Australia, but there are certainly problems with crowds globally. Now, English football has managed to clean its act up tremendously well in the last 15 years. It is not the basket case it was as far as the crowds go. So they've realised that there was a problem, and they've done proactive things about it. Now, Australia's nowhere near as bad as that, but unless we do recognise that these issues do exist, then it will get as bad as that.
The one thing I would say there is I think the English football is a lot longer than 15 years. They cleared things up in the late 90s, so it's probably 20 years. But the thing that people are forgetting here is that, again, there's a mob mentality. Whenever you have people who support a team passionately, turn all their attention on it, sport is a passionate thing, then you have a mob mentality. And then you have immense rivalries which have been stemmed from various things over a number of years. And this is one of the things that I don't like, is that the FFA has been trying to manufacture rivalries. Rivalries will happen over events that happen either on the pitch or something a coach says. And so there's something that happened. It may be geographical, and there are those rivalries. You can't change it. And the sad thing is, again, sport does attract the criminal element. Whether you see it on the terraces by amongst the fans, but there are also people, as we know, and anyone who says it's not happening, people involved in football are laundering money. There's even an investigation we've mentioned on the show before, where the European Interpol are investigating the trafficking of people via football clubs from Africa, in that there are football agents who are putting forward people for a football trial. They turn up in, say, the Netherlands, they're absolutely useless, can't play football, then they disappear. And so, this is a major problem. Football's being used for trafficking people. We've heard even of sport in Australia, where players have been carrying drugs across the country. So, there is, in sport, there are problems because it has that ability to sort of attract people and do various things or organise things. Even if you look at football in Africa, in Ghana, where Ghana was fighting for its independence and it was the first African nation to gain independence, the British, who were in power at the time, wouldn't allow public meetings of people to discuss it. So the politicians or the independence movement decided to attach themselves to football clubs, because that meant they could then legally travel around claiming to be fans but preach the message of independence, which Ghana got in the end and was the first nation in Africa to get their independence. So I think sport and the crowds and all of that have been used for various purposes for a very, very long time and would always will be.
One of the things I find is that it seems as though the Australian football supporter has a chip on their shoulder. When I speak to English people or overseas people about football, they're quite happy to talk about other sports as well and not feel that intimidated by them. Whereas the Australian football fan seems to have this idea that, you know, every other sport's out to get them, the media's out to get them, and that the word popular is mutually inclusive with greatest, best, and a whole stream of other words that it's just not associated with. And until football stops worrying about what AFL's doing or what that journalist is saying, the better off they'll be. I mean, the lady who started all this off, Rebecca Wilson, I don't think she's ever written a positive story about football, and anybody that's followed what she has read would know that. So, yes, I think she does have an agenda. But at the same time, her report is a police report. She just didn't write this stuff out of thin air. It came from a police report. There are concerns within the police service of this behaviour. And, you know, just take a chill pill, Australian football fans. No one's telling you your sport is rubbish and crap. No one is telling you that you're all a bunch of idiots. There are idiots everywhere. If you are, as you say, the most popular sport in the world, well, you're going to have more than your fair share of idiots than other sports. It's just the way it's going to go.
The only thing I would say, John, to that is someone who, and I think things have improved in certain areas, but there was for a very long time a deliberate move by certain sections of the media to put the game down and slam it wherever possible. I mean, if you remember, there was Channel 9 showed library footage of football violence, and they actually got fined for that because they claimed that that was what had actually happened. And that was, I think, back in the 90s when I'd been in Australia for about 10 years or so. So there was always that case where they were trying to put the game down and stop it maybe fulfilling its potential. I think you can also argue, if you look at the West Australian, how many AFL writers do they have on that
sure.
newspaper, and how many dedicated football writers with people who actually know the game as well as their AFL writers? They have none anymore. Since Mel Moffat and Jonathan Cook went, that is how seriously they take the game. So I think the football fans in Australia do have a point to a certain degree when they look at, again, who they have covering their sport for certain media outlets. You could even say the same when Peter Wilkins was covering the W League for the ABC. There's another guy who has no sense for the game or feel for the game whatsoever, and was a man who was humiliated in a press conference in Germany by Gus Hiddink because his knowledge was so poor. Gus Hiddink asked him to explain his question, and he just pulled a buzz phrase about football. And I mean, I've never seen a man flounder so much in a press conference in my life. So I think they do have a point, and I do think the media outlets, if they want to cover it, and this is the sad thing, I'd rather they were honest and said, look, we don't want to cover it, so rather than paying it lip service and giving us people who have no idea about the game trying to cover it.
Yeah, and I think we've got to make a big distinction here between what is a reputable media service and what is just tabloid crap. And I'm sorry, but the shows that go to air at 6 o'clock are tabloid crap. I mean, they're really rubbish. You can't hardly trust a word that comes out of the mouths of any of those people or the stories that they show. So if you're taking your football news off your football reporting off the 6 o'clock news and taking that as your standard of reporting, then that's what you're going to get. And that goes across all sports as well. I mean, the AFL reporting on a certain channel is total rubbish. It is complete rubbish. And so you don't watch that channel. You go and find where the real news is.
I've got to be honest, I haven't watched any of those channels for probably 10 years.
Yeah, I just tend to avoid them if I can. And I think also one thing to point out with this stuff about crowds, in the last week here in Perth, we've had a gentleman jailed for 8 months for pushing someone in the throat in the crowd. Now, the vision of that is plastered all over the internet. That person has been pilloried from left to right in society, and it's not for me to say whether that's right or wrong, but it has actually happened. And I still haven't seen the video footage of the footballing fans that have been pillaged. I just think that some of these people need to take a chill pill and realise that it is not just happening in their sport. And you try swearing at an AFL game, you'll be out of the crowd in quick smart. And it's just the way society's going. I think it's overzealous on all on the side of security these days. People aren't allowed to have as much fun as they used to be able to get up to in a sporting contest. And maybe that's part of the issue as well, is, you know, what is an acceptable level of public behaviour at a sporting contest? Do we all have to sit there in our chairs and politely clap? Or are we allowed to get up and show some emotion and get into it?
No, I agree with you there. I think it has become very sanitised. I think it's also very sad that, you know, kids are no longer allowed to run on the pitch the way they used to. And I know, again, that was ruined by a few idiots. But we seem to be policing everything on the basis of there are two or three or five or ten idiots, when the rest of us can behave in a way that is, you know, acceptable or actually enjoyable, you know. So it's very sad. I don't know what the answer is, but we'll have to leave that for another day.
We should certainly be looking at the English model for what they do in Premier League football. And that goes across not just football here, but all sporting contests. Because they're obviously doing something right. And people can still go to those games and obviously express the emotion and have fun and do all the things that they've always been able to without going home with a dart between their eyes.
Well, John, I think we've run out of time. We've tried to put the sporting world to rights once more, but I'm sure we'll have another go the next time we catch up.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time, Ash.
Thank you.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is foul.
See ya. We'll be back next week.